Views and opinions expressed on this show or any other show on Hronco Radio Network are not necessarily those reflective of Hronco Radio owners, affiliates, or local sponsors. Any hurt feelings and mixed emotions infringing upon the PC movement should be referred to Hronco's Human Services Department, which can be reached at blah, 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 to which time you will be told to shut it. On behalf of Hronco Radio Network,
I would like to take this time now to thank you from the bottom of our blackened souls. Thank you! Ha, 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 ha!
Ah, it is so good to see you again, sir. I see you have brought your friends with you this time. Very good, sir. Would you like your usual table? Right this way, then, sir. Please follow me.
Who are we kidding? We're not that stuffy.
I knew I was being threatened. Do you think it's worth holding out? I mean, I've heard some pretty ugly things about those guys. Ugly stories. Watch them
flee! Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for Politics Cafe, where we sit down and discuss anything and everything. No holds barred. Bring any topic to the table. We don't care. We'll discuss it. Come on in. Sit down. Take a load off. Now, the host of the show, Mark.
All right. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, and fellow conversationalists around the world, and welcome once again to the Politics Cafe at www.hernco.com. Politics Cafe is a small cafe located on an isolated stretch of the information superhighway where we get together once a week and grill up some fresh topics for your digestion. And a topic this week, folks, we're going to talk about money. A lot of talk over the last couple of weeks here with my liberal friends, bitching and moaning. They finally woke up to the fact that the insurance companies are the ones who will be servicing their health care. And, you know, it's like, oh, geez, now all of a sudden they don't like Obama anymore, and they're going down hard on all the representatives, their senators, what have you. And it looks like the ejection election of 2010 is going to become a reality where they all get tossed, because they do have everybody really PO'd. Now, there's still a lot of them out there saying, well, you know, I still think Obama's done some good things. But none of them have been able to come up with a damn thing about it. But at any rate, tonight's topic is going to be about money. And it's something that had to be brought up, and it's something I was kind of hoping one or two of the liberals that were really heavily into this argument were going to make it to the show here tonight. And actually, I think they are listening, so welcome aboard. But it's a matter of them, geez, can we get on to rebut whatever it is you're going to say, especially after last week's show. It was funny. They're saying, oh, geez, listen to this drivel, you know. You got people listening to that? I said, yeah, I know I got people listening to that. I mean, you know, but what exactly was drivel? Well, you know, geez, and then we get to all the ha-has and ho-hos and hum-hums and geez. And I said, okay, good. Well, since you had nothing in there in particular that you could point out as being drivel, obviously, you know, let's face it, you know, you don't like me, you don't like what I'm saying, that's fine, I ain't got a problem with that. But if you can't refute what I'm saying, ain't no point in you just calling it dribble. But anyway, we're going to go down the whole topic of money here tonight. I got a good friend of mine on board, Mr. Skip Sanders, recently from the Captain's Block show that used to run here on Hernco and run over at PL4 at our network, the old network there. Skip is quite the expert on this as well as myself. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I'm an expert on money, but there's a few things about money that I understand. And I think we're going to go down a little road here tonight. And I think the road that we're going to start with is going to have to start with a thing that's called value. And value is something that people just don't seem to be able to put a real grip on. So we're going to have to define that word value. And I think that that's something that's got to look at here, because it's important, you know. And what does value mean? Well, value is actually something that you wish to obtain and to keep, all right? And that is what a value is. You know, take a look at anything, any of your possessions whatsoever that you value. And I'm not talking about character traits or anything else like that. I'm talking about physical, tangible things that you place value on. Your car, your home, your toys, your tools, what have you, what is their actual value to you. Let's start with your home. What is the actual value of your home? And I'm not going to sit down and talk about the price about it yet, because we'll get into that in a little bit. But the value of your home is this, if you really stop and think about it. All right? Sorry there, Mr. Gonzo Nation. we'll forget that shit. The point here being is, look, the value of your house is, A, number one, it is your climate control system. It is what protects you from the elements. Up here in the north, it protects us from getting too damn cold. It keeps the snow off our heads. It keeps the rain off our heads. It keeps the wind outside. It does all sorts of nice things. But basically, it is a place where you can control your climate. And that is its value to you. In the wintertime, it keeps you warm. In the summertime, it keeps you cool. It's a place where you can safely store your stuff, all the rest of your stuff, a place where you can keep it, where you can find it, you know. And these are all things that relate to its value. Now, take a look at your tools. Your tools are valuable in that they allow you to perform your work, no matter what it is. Now, whether you use your tools for pleasure, joy, making money, what have you, value in your tools is what it is that you can do with them. Same with your toys. You know, you got a car, you got a motorcycle, you got a snowmobile, you got a water ski, you got any sort of form of transportation whatsoever. The value of that actual thing is something that can take you from one place to another in some other method than your own locomotion. A, walking. You know, this is what we're talking about here. It's, you want to go anywhere. Hey, you know, you're going to need wheels, or you're going to need a boat, or you're going to need a plane, or you're going to need something. If you want to get there in some other method than walking. You know, even if all you have at this point in time is a horse, a mule, a jackass, or something like that. All right, it is still, its value is that it allows you to get from one place to another without walking. The point that I'm trying to get across here is that a value of something is something that you wish to obtain and keep and use for your own benefit. And that is what a real value is. Now, a lot of people say, yeah, but what is the cost? Well, the cost is something we're going to get into tonight here with money. Now, money in its origins, okay, is basically something that some people will tell you, well, it's a form of storing wealth or a form of being able to exchange your wealth. All right, it's a medium of exchange. And a lot of people will come out there and say, well, you know, it's just a random sort of thing. We can use whatever you want for money. But that isn't exactly true. All right, and the reason being that real money has what is called an intrinsic value. And an intrinsic value means that it has a value of something that it that comes. Let me put it to you this way: an intrinsic value it means it has some other value other than what you're using it for. When I say that money has an intrinsic value, that means that whatever it is that you're using for money has some value other than money, and it's also something that other people accept as a value. If other people did not accept it as a value, they would not accept it as money. Some of the early pages of mankind's history, bits of metal. You know, and I would refer back to the old British Isles where they used to use little tin hatchets for money. And the thing about it was the tin itself had an intrinsic value. You gathered enough of those little tin hatchets up and you could melt them down and pound them into a pot or a pan or a fork or a knife or a weapon or some other use with the metal. Now, of course, you know, you would trade off your labor or whatever it was that you were producing with your labor for these little tin hatchets. And the reason that you produce, you pass them on was because other people had this same value for it. People were accepting that because they had an intrinsic value on their own. And the same thing over the ages happened to come along when we got into using other things like copper and nickel and silver and gold. Now, gold became the one that was probably the most valuable out of all of them over the centuries because of its properties, because of the fact that it never tarnished, it never changed anything, it would never rust, it would never oxidize, there were many, many things, and it would sit there and it would be gold as long as you had it. It would not change, no matter how many times it changed hands, no matter how long it was stored, no matter whether it fell in the damned ocean, sitting in salt water, or whether it was buried in the ground or anything else. You dug it up again, it was still gold. And if it was hammered into a nice and beautiful shape, it could be something that people would covet. And it would, like I say, it was something that never actually lost its intrinsic value. It was what it was. Because of its shine, because of its luster, and because of its long-lasting qualities against tarnishing, people valued it as such. And because many, many beautiful things could be made out of it. Right, it was desired, you know, and Skip here, my buddy, Skip Sanders, is coming on. Skip, you know, I want to get you up to the mic here because I know I only got you for the first hour of the show. But, you know, tell me if I'm wrong with any of this here, and tell me if you can extrapolate a little bit on just what I mean by the word of value, especially when it applies to things that we've been using over the centuries here, such as, you know, gold, silver, and whatnot.
Oh, thanks for the generous introduction and compliments earlier there, Mark. I appreciate that. Money evolved out of utility. You know, I mean, back in the origins of it, it had four basic principles. It was rare. It was uncommon. It was highly desired. It was a reliable store of wealth, and it was widely accepted, you know. And so... You know, the original coins, whether they be gold, silver, or what have you, you know, people recognize the rarity of the metal that went into it. And they also recognize the labor that was necessary to get it up out of the ground, to then process it and pound it into a coin of some sort. And the utility of the trade between individuals versus a cobbler, you know, who's got a skill, certainly in making shoes, you know, probably needs a handful of chickens every week to feed his family. Now, I hope the poultry farmer, needed, you know, five pairs of shoes a week. Because without money, it was impossible for the two of them to do business. Because eventually the poultry farmer would have all the shoes that he could possibly need. And so money evolved out of utility, for ease of transaction, to allow for specialization amongst trades. And so these are the early origins of money, and it worked quite well, provided that everything was transparent. It's when notes and paper currency gets into the mix that we really start to have problems with fraud in money, and inflation of money, and this is, you know, where the old money change comes into play, when we insert the paper note into the accounting of it, of the whole money scheme. And but so far I think, you know, you've been right on. Now, you know, value, the perceived value is of the coin is relative in terms to my specialty and my time, my labor, my resources that are put into any given project, and what I'm willing personally to barter for that. You know, if I'm willing to paint your house over the course of an afternoon for 15 gold pieces, it's because I perceive those 15 gold pieces are going to then be exchanged in the marketplace for, you know, the staple foods that I need necessary to feed myself for a period of days, or my family for a period of days. I have already perceived in my mind my time plus my resources in the value of tangible goods and services that I'm going to exchange for society in that. And the money itself is just the medium that allows me to go from painting your house to converting my time, my effort, my energy, my labor, and my resources, the paint that I put onto your house. The money is just the utility that allows me to convert that into bacon, eggs, milk, flour, etc. That it is necessary for, you know, me to assist or sustain, you know. Money's just the vehicle. It wasn't meant in its original orientation, its original evolution. It was not meant to be something that was manipulated, you know, that had a changing value. That, you know, today it would get me 5 gallons of milk, an hour's worth of my labor painting would get me, you know, and tomorrow maybe 3 gallons of milk. If you have a money supply or a money system that's value, it relative to goods and services is constantly changing, then you don't have a very good money system. And people will lose confidence in that money system, and they will shun it as a medium of exchange. And that's why, you know, commodity-based currencies, whether that be gold, silver, or metals, or, you know, in the early days of the United States, we had cotton notes, we had citrus notes, we had monies backed by different currencies, backed by different commodities. They were all, each man, woman, child, whatever, would judge its utility versus their time, their effort, and their resources necessary to acquire whatever else it was that they wanted to exchange, whether that be, you know, shoes from the cobbler, whether that be, you know, dishes from the ceramicist or what have you. So, you know, money, again, it needs to be rare, it needs to be widely accepted, and it needs to be a reliable store of value. And if it has those things, then people will have confidence in it, generally speaking, and use it as a medium of exchange. You know, a far cry from where we are today, you know, but I hope I was helpful in that. My thoughts were a little scattered there, Mark, but, you know, anyway, I'm going to pass this back over to you.
All right, good. You hit on quite a bit of it there. Basically, the reason that you took it in exchange for your goods, your labor, what have you, was all because it was a token of honor. And the reason that you took it and you accepted it is because you had faith in the fact that you could carry it into the marketplace and exchange it for the goods and the services that you desired to purchase from others. You know, and it relied on the fact that others were willing to take it. And that was a very, very big point about the whole situation with money. If other people weren't going to take whatever it was that you were taking for money, well, you wouldn't take it. You know, it's that simple. You know, you got to sit down and look at the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation is this, that if no one else was going to take that money, you know, you better have a use for it. You better be able to convert it into the things you need yourself, because if not, it was of no use to you and you would seek something else. You know, you would demand from whoever it was that you were doing business with, you know, some other medium of exchange. You know, I mean, let's face it, barter trade is exactly what was going on here. You know, if you sit down and you look at the reality of the situation, you were bartering your time and your efforts for the efforts of someone else, and you were using that as an exchange. And in the end here, the big key point of this was, it was a barter. You know, and a lot of people seem to get slipped away from this here, you know. They'll take a look at it and they'll turn around and say, well, this is capitalism, you know, which in a way, yes, it is, you know what I mean? But although capitalism, the way it's defined nowadays, it's got so many different definitions. It's very, very hard to take a look and pinpoint any one of them and say, yeah, well, that's true. But the fact of the matter is, you know, it's money rested on the fact that other people were willing to accept it, because if they weren't, you wouldn't accept it. And that's a very, very key position that I'm trying to make right here tonight. It's you know, without that ability, you know, without your faith and the fact that you couldn't move it, Why bother? You gotta look for something else. So this is what we meant by an intrinsic value of money. Now, Skip went on to speak about it, things in there. And a lot of agricultural societies, or societies that were based on agriculture, you know, the agricultural goods were stored in a large warehouse that was safe, you know, in something or another. And there was a, quite often you would have notes written against those goods. And those notes were only good for a specific quantity of whatever those goods were in there. Now, these goods might have enough of a value out there where you could turn around and say, let's say here you got a note in your hand that says this is worth 100 oranges, you know, just for the sake of argument. Well, look, oranges are good. They got vitamin C. They got all kinds of good things in them. It's a necessary part of your diet. Somebody somewhere is going to be able to use 100 oranges. Now, as long as those 100 oranges are in there, they haven't rotted yet, that note is good. You know, so that note had a time value on it. Now, if we're going against something like cotton, okay, now that cotton might last a whole lot longer. You know, you might have a note that states that you got 100 bales of cotton sitting in a warehouse somewhere. Well, that note actually had two factors to it. A, it was good for those 100 bales of cotton. But it also had something called a geographical factor, because that cotton that it was written against was sitting in a certain specific place somewhere. Now, the further away from that place where that cotton was sitting, the earth, you know, if you got 500 miles away from it, you might find somebody that would be willing to trade you a good or a service for that note. But it was resting on the fact that that person knew he could take that note back to that cotton warehouse and collect the cotton on it, or be able to trade it in the area of that cotton warehouse to get things that he needed. All right, but the further and further away it got, the harder it was for whoever it was that had that note to get back there to cash it in on whatever the underlying value of it was. And that's the key thing here. You know, and like Skip was saying there before, where shenanigans come into play is when somebody would fake a note, somebody would counterfeit it. Take it back to the warehouse there and find out that this isn't a real note. Now all of a sudden you're beat on it. So, you know, the further away you got, there was that much more of a suspicion that it could be counterfeit, and it may not be accepted at all. Now, the reason that gold and silver and whatnot were accepted, because it was easily tested for what they were, and they could be traded anywhere. And generally, they were good for favors from whoever the ruling class at the time was, which is also something very important. And the ruling class themselves, knowing the value of it, would use them to purchase the goods and services that they needed. You know, whether it be to build a castle, build your home, build gardens, finance an army to go and conquer the world, what have you. It didn't matter, you know, and those people would only take that because they knew that they would be able to spend it anywhere they went, somewhere along the line. Precious stones have always had that sort of a value to them. In the Far East, opium works the same way. A big chunk of opium will get you anywhere you want to go in the Middle East, or in the Far East. You know, it will pay for meals, it will pay for rooms, it will pay for all kinds of things. Because it's one of those things there. Even if the user, even if whoever it was you were trading, had no use himself for the opium, he knew that somebody out there would give him a value for that opium that he could use. And this is very, very important. So it had what's called an intrinsic value. Now I want to fast forward a little bit here to what's going on here today. All right, and what's happened over the last 100 years or so, you know, with the creation of what we call Federal Reserve notes. Now, for the first portion of this century, or the last century, when Federal Reserve notes first came into view, there was always a little disclaimer written on the notes. And the disclaimer stated, as a matter of fact, I have one here in front of me, and if I can dig it out and read exactly what it says on there. It's got some very, very, very interesting words written on it. Let me see if I can read one of these right out here to you. What it says is that this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and is redeemable for lawful money at the United States Treasury or at any Federal Reserve Bank. Now, it's very important that you take a look at two words words in there, and those words are lawful money. All right, because by the law and the supreme law of this land, the Constitution of the United States, well, has a disclaimer in there that states that only gold and silver can be used in payment of debts. Okay, now because that is written into our Constitution, that is what makes it lawful money. And it's very, very important that you understand the difference between lawful money and legal tender. Now, legal tender is just that. It is a tender. It is something you tender in exchange. Now, the only reason that these notes were any good for the longest time was because they could be redeemed for lawful money, which meant that if before the Federal Reserve could print one of those notes, it had to have $10 worth of silver or $10 worth of gold in reserve in the bank, which is what it stood for, so that you could take that to the United States Treasury or to any Federal Reserve Bank and exchange it for lawful money. Very, very important. As such, the amount of notes that were written or that were printed by the Federal Reserve had to be backed up by what they call specie. Okay, and that specie would be the gold or silver. And very important terms to think of. You say, where are you going with all this? Well, where they have gone, excuse me, is the fact that they are no longer backed by gold or silver, or what is known as lawful money. All right, nowadays, money is created out of debt. We have gotten into a position here where money is actually a note of debt. When you take a look at a modern dollar bill, all it says on it is that this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Stop. And you will also take a note that at the end of that sentence, there is no period. Whereas on all these old notes, there was a period, which made that a legal statement or a lawful statement. And it was, the point about it is here, with no period on the end of that statement, it's really not even a legal statement. It's not really even a legal, piece of paper. Now, right now, the only reason these pieces of paper are still in use as they are today is, because people accept them. Now, we accept them, for pretty much the same reason we accepted any kind of money in the past. You know, in exchange for our labors, in exchange for our produce, so to say. You know, whether you're exchanging your labor or a good or a service or what have you, you accept that for the reason of being able to go out into a marketplace and exchange it for other notes or for the things that you need, for the values that you wish to acquire, whether it be food, you know, whether it be housing, what have you. But one of the things that's got to be remembered about all money, whether we are using gold, silver, copper, or these funny-looking notes that we are using today, is the fact that what we are using is a commodity. Now, a commodity is anything whatsoever that you have any numerous items of. Cotton is a commodity. Soybeans are a commodity. Corn is a commodity. Wheat is a commodity. Silver is a commodity. Oil is a commodity. Gold is a commodity. All of these things are all commodities. Now, the price, I don't mean the value here, but I mean the price of any commodity in any marketplace is governed by a law. And this is a natural law, so to speak. This is a law like gravity that cannot be broken. And it is called the law of supply and demand. When you have a large supply and you have a low demand of that commodity, okay, its price is very low. Its value or its cost, very, very low. When you have a high demand, when lots and lots of people want it, and you have a very low quantity of it, and you have a very high price on it, and only the richest can afford it. This is what is meant by supply and demand. And this is a law. It's just like gravity. You can't break it. It's a natural law. It's something that has occurred. Now, over the years, throughout time, money has been in fluctuation. There's always been times in the past when there was a plentitude of money, and there have been times in the past when there were shortages of money. And when these things happened, other things came about. When you had too much money in a marketplace, its value went down. you could get it down almost to a point where you would have the mercantilism that you had in Spain way back when. After Spain discovered the New World and found all the gold that there was here, and they started bringing tons and tons of gold back to Spain, they got into a thing that was called mercantilism. All right, well, basically, damn near every Spaniard and his uncle was involved in trade. They were going out with that gold and buying things all over the world and bringing those things back for sale in Spain. As a result, very, very few Spanish people were producing anything of any wealth. There was enough money there for them to get involved in some sort of a merchant business, and which is why they called it at the time mercantilism. Is where it came from. The people themselves really produced very little. And as a result, because they had so much money, they figured, hey, we don't have to. We can always trade this money for what you have. But the money itself on the home front in Spain actually became very, very low in cost, low in value, low in price. It took a lot of money to go and buy anything from anyone else. All right, because everybody had it, you don't need it. Okay? You know, what you needed were your daily things. You needed housing, you needed food, you needed clothing, you needed shoes, you needed eggs, what have you. And in order to get these things, okay, you had to be able to go to the people who produced these things and trade for them. Now, these people that, you know, are producing these things are only going to be able to produce so much. And if you are looking for a limited quantity of the food, clothing, what have you, and you've got a ton of money, you're going to find out that you are bidding against other people with a ton of money to get the same damn things. All right? And this is what it's all about here. You know, that's, and this is the point that we're trying to make. Now, nowadays, we are in a position of what we call inflation. All right, and this inflation has been going on for a long, long, long time. It's been very slow, it's been very steady, though. And that's the thing, you know, it's been creeping up. Every now and then, it gets to a point where it gets a little out of hand. You know, nowadays, it has actually, if you look at things, gotten out of hand to a point where, you know, it's almost getting out of control. It's gotten to a point where the government is almost in denial of it. I mean, look at the consumer price index that we have out there right now. Volatile items, which were removed from the list, by the Clinton administration, about 10, 15 years ago, were done so because of the fact that there was so much money in the marketplace and a lot of things were flying up in price in a bad way. Food was taken off of it. Now, certain food items, at any rate, a lot of food items, let me give you an example. All right, I don't know how many of you folks have been buying coffee through your lives, but if you'll remember back in the 60s when you went in and you bought a pound of coffee, that pound of coffee weighed 16 ounces. Well, have you gone in and seen what a pound of coffee weighs today? A 1 pound can of coffee, or what you used to look at as a 1 pound can of coffee, now only contains 11 ounces. Same with a bag of potato chips. They went from a pound down to 14 ounces, and now they're down to 11. You get much less coffee for a whole lot more money. Reason being, because there is so much more money in the marketplace. It gets spread around. Now, this money is created by debt. It's created by the debt that's incurred when people buy homes. Mortgages are a huge backer of money nowadays, and the actual specie behind it is your land and your houses and everything else. A lot of people just don't seem to realize. Plus, this government is also involved in something called quantitative easing, which is basically just printing money out of thin air with nothing whatsoever to back it up. Now, in the old days, prior to 1917, prior to the creation of the Federal Reserve, there were different laws concerning things. And there was also a different method of handling how money worked in the marketplace. When there was too much money, and its value was going down, its cost was going down, it did not become worth it to dig it out of the ground anymore. And as such, mines closed down, mints closed down, metal refineries closed down and went out of work. And they would stay that way until there became a shortage of money. The population grew when goods and services and the need for more money went up. Okay, what happened then was the money itself. Now, when money became short in supply, became very valuable because people would do whatever they could to get their hands on it. And a little bit of money would go a whole lot further than a lot of money would before. When you got into that situation, it was worthwhile to open the mines back up. And it was worthwhile to open the refineries back up and to open the mints back up and to produce more money for the marketplace. All right, and this is what you call a natural boom and bust cycle. It was very natural because it depended upon what happened out in the marketplace with goods and services. You know, if there were many goods and services being produced and not enough money around to take care of it so that people could buy it, there was more money brought into creation because money had more value. It was worth it to go into the ground, dig the stuff out, refine it, and stamp it into coins, you know, because you could make a profit on it. Okay, now that profit back then is called a seigniorage. All right, something you might want to go take a look and see. But at any rate, the point that I'm trying to make here is that even throughout all of history, there have always been boom and bust cycles that went along with the money supply. The difference between then and now is the fact that now the ones we have are artificially created. Whereas back in the old days, they were created naturally. All right, if the economy itself was expanding and money came into short supply, they went and they made more money to cover this. And if they made too much money and it started to lose value, then it wasn't worth it for them to dig it out of the ground. It wasn't worth it for them to stamp it. Wasn't worth it for them to refine it. All right, exactly, Pox. It depended upon the rate of growth with the economy. The money supply would grow. It would generally lag a little bit behind, or, it would generally lag behind a little bit of the growth. But the fact of the matter is, the recessions that you had back then, the money shortages and the devaluation and inflation was very, very short-lived because the market itself, okay, free markets, per se, would take and get and regulate the money supply, you know, because money being a commodity like everything else, being a trade commodity, was governed by the natural laws that govern free marketplaces. You know, it was, there's the whole thing there. In the 1800s, they were not whopper recessions. They were actually very, very localized recessions that went on in various places and didn't last long. You know, they would happen. There was no doubt about it. Now, there was also a couple other things that happened back in then that, let me see if I can put this into words here. I tell you, my throat's a little ripped up here tonight, so it's still kind of tough. But one of the things that this country had a bit of a problem with was the fact that in our Constitution, Congress took upon itself the power to regulate the values of gold and silver. Now, this was actually in itself setting a double standard, and Congress realized this almost immediately. After its formation and after they had written that Constitution, you know, they had come into a couple of different places. Number one, the biggest place was the penny. Believe it or not, the penny was almost a half ounce of copper at the time. And after a while, I started to find out that, look, you know, if people use pennies, they're going to have to do something different. Because a penny was actually, you could buy things with a penny, you know. And you had two or three pennies in your hand. Believe it or not, you could go buy a meal for it. You get yourself a cup of coffee. You could get, you know, various things that the pennies were worthwhile, but pennies being the size they were in a shortage, so they turned around and took those pennies and made them all smaller so that there were more of them to go around. Same thing happened with gold and silver. Take a witness to the various acts throughout the 1800s where they were regulating the amount of gold that was in a gold coin. When gold was in short supply, they would have to, they would have to cut down the amount of gold that was actually in a gold coin. And when gold became abundant, well, they would richen it back up. But they ran into problems with it, especially in the late 1800s, and especially after the gold rush. You know, there was so much gold that was coming out of California and different places like this that a lot of places weren't taking anything but gold. You know, why the hell should I bother selling you something for your silver when I have all of these customers out there that are willing to give me gold? This became a problem. and the Coinage Act of 1873. As a matter of fact, it was one of the efforts that Congress had tried to make. Now, the problem here was is that Congress was trying to regulate the value of two commodities against each other, you know, and never, ever, ever set a standard. Now, indeed, in fact, the standard was set finally in 1949 by the International Monetary Fund, which set the standard of monetary currency around the world at the 1949 United States silver dollar. And that was the first time that anybody actually sat down and said, this will be the standard. And what the United States of America should have done way back then was go right ahead and mint gold coins. There's nothing wrong with minting a gold coin. The problem was is they were stamping the $20 on it. Had they stamped them and just said 1 ounce oro puro, 1 ounce gold, 99%, 990, whatever it was, those golds would have floated at a market value relative to silver. You know, the silver dollar itself. You know, there were times when, you know, people would pay, people would take $20 in gold for something. But if you were going to spend silver on it, they wanted 25. Or they wanted 26. So it was a rough thing to look at back then. You know what I mean? They really had a lot of problems with it. And as a result of all the gold that was flush around back then, your bankers, as a rule, really didn't want to deal with anything but gold, especially when it came to the international banking market. And this came to such a bad head that back in 1896, we were actually damn near ready to go to war over it with a few different people. And lovers of history out there may recall certain William Jennings Bryan giving a speech to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1896. It was the famous Cross of Gold speech. Famous Cross of Gold speech, which a lot of people say back then, you know, well, they will quote the one line out of the speech and generally take it out of context. This, you know, thou shalt not crucify mankind on a cross of gold. If you sit down and read the whole speech, what you'll find is that it's what William Jennings Bryan was telling the world back then was that we, the United States of America, excuse me, were the leading manufacturer in the world. And if we decided to use both silver and gold, or what he called bimetallism, then the rest of the world was going to have to go along with us. We didn't have to go along with the international bankers of the world. They could get screwed. If we wanted to use silver and gold and regulate itself against each other the way we were, we had every right to do that because of who we were, because of the power that we had behind us, and because of the manufacturing power that we had behind us. Now, a lot of people took that along to say, well, you know, that's the reason that we created a Federal Reserve. Well, it's not, as a matter of fact. But as a matter of fact, it is at the top of the hour here, and I have got to wet the whistle here and get my throat a little lubricated. So I'm going to take a short break. Folks, we'll be right back. You're listening to the Politics Cafe. This is my name's Mark Belcher, and it's we're at www.hernco.com. And yeah, folks, right back after these messages. Take a look over at hernco.com and buy something, will you? And we'll be right back, folks.
What I learned from watching TV after school. 1. If you fall madly in love with a great guy, make sure he isn't your best friend, your best friend's ex-boyfriend, your ex-boyfriend's best friend, your ex-best friend's boyfriend, or somebody named Seth. Hello. 2. Never leave home without a wooden stake, lip gloss, and a push-up bra. 2A. Platform shoes are always a plus. Okay. 3. If you find a note in your locker that asks you to meet a secret admirer in an abandoned shipyard, do not go. It really smells like fish there.
Hey, want to get more out of your teenage years? Click on www.weprevent.org and learn how to help make a difference in your neighborhood. Tutor younger kids, help clean up a community park, or even start a teen corps. All these things help make your world a safer and better place to live. as well as making you a better person. Click on WePrevent.org or call 1-800-722-TEENS to find out what you can do. A public service message from McGruff, the U.S. Department of Justice, the Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the Ad Council.
This next question is for Caroline. Caroline, if you take the bus 60 miles to school at 5:30 a.m. and the bus is traveling at an average of 30 miles per hour, how are you going to get to your prenatal appointment and still make it to homeroom on time?
Some students are tackling more than just their schoolwork, which is why more than 30% of them aren't graduating. But you can give them the boost they need to make it through by visiting boostup.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
LOL. Well, AISI, it was NBD.
Kids are spending more and more time online, and even if you heard what they're typing, you probably wouldn't know what they're saying.
Some PPL, whatever. ISS.
They chat online in a language full of acronyms, and unless you use it every day, you won't understand it.
YIWGP.
You won't know what they're saying or who they're saying it to. A lot of times, neither do they. Every day, children are sexually solicited online. So here's an acronym for you. HDOP. Help Delete Online Predators. To protect your kids' online life and to get a full list of acronyms kids are using, call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
Aloha, this is Bill Sage of Wiley and Sage, and you're listening to Hearn Net Radio. Music and talk, just one click away. Operators are standing. Bye now. Disclaimers not included. Your mileage may vary if rash persists. Your doctor, Ken Dahl, sold separately.
All right, folks. Now, the second half of the show. Welcome back. This is the Politics Cafe. My name is Mark Belcher. We're broadcasting from www.hernco.com. And we're getting in. We're talking about money, banking, and a lot of other things here tonight. Now, one of the things my biggest complaint about what's going on today is the fact that, well, actually, it's not a new complaint. This is actually... goes back to way back whenever. I mean, one of the things that's happened is, let me see if I can just put this into perspective here for you folks. Long ago, back in Scotland, let's go back even further. Let's go back to ancient China. Now, back when Marco Polo first went into China, and he went in there as a merchant with his father and his uncle. And he actually managed to find favor with the Chinese court, with a guy named Kublai Khan. And no need to get into the story about how he found favor, although it's a very interesting one, and I would suggest you read the travels of Marco Polo. Part of what he had done after he had found favor was he got hired by the court to perform various functions. And he had gone, the court decided to pay him. Now, on his first paycheck, so to speak, they handed him a fistful of paper. And the paper all had various denominations on it, and it all had the seal on it. And Marco Polo took one look at it and says, look, I don't want Pagliari, which is what he called it in Italian. He says, I want the real thing. You know, give me something else. Give me gold. Give me silver. Give me precious stones. Give me something I can carry elsewhere and use. And he had a rough time with the people who were handing him that paper because they were officially the king's men. And the king's men assured him that he could spend it. And not to worry that in their central bank they had something backing it up. So as such, when Marco Polo came back from China, he introduced the idea of paper money to the world. and got us into the idea of storing money in a place, taking receipts for the money, and using those receipts in exchange, just like you would use money or use coin or anything else. And as long as the receipts were drawn against something that was usable or at a place where you could take them, they're fine. It wasn't a bad idea. After a while, it seemed to work out good for a lot of people. They didn't have to worry about, having to walk around with tons and tons of heavy metals on them in order to perform major transactions. They could actually perform those transactions on paper, and the money would be transferred from one account to another in a banking institution. Now, fast forward this to a few hundred years to a Scot banker living in Scotland who found himself a lender to the King of England to finance a war against France. Now, the King of England, of course, he could basically could have went in and taken the Scots money, but the Scot wouldn't let him do it. The Scot, as a matter of fact, what he did was he lent the King the money to go out and fight it, which meant a good chunk of his gold reserves and whatnot. And the King, of course, wrote him a large note, that stated, here, I will pay you this back at this much of an interest in this much time. It's the only way he could talk the Scotch banker into doing it. Well, the Scot banker, who was also printing notes against what gold and what reserves he had in there, found himself at a problem. Because all of a sudden everybody that was doing business with him knew damn well that he could lend that money, or that he did not have that gold in deposit there. And all they had were the receipts for it. What he started to do, or at least what he figured out that he could do, was instead of printing the notes against actual gold and silver and precious stones that he had in reserve, was that he could print notes against the note that the King of England wrote to him. All right, yes, goldsmiths were doing the same thing here. That's correct, Pox. But what this Scot banker figured out at the time, aside from starting up with fractional reserve banking, which is something else he did, he understood that all of a sudden, and notes of that were backed up by a debt that was owed to him by the King of England. And this was kind of a shady thing, but who the hell was going to gainsay the King of England? Nobody. Okay? It was the kind of thing you could use that note for now, but don't you worry about a thing, because the King promised it. And if you're going to sit here and tell me that the King isn't going to make good on it, well, you're going to have to go listen to the King's guards. Because the King's guards are going to have a problem with you. So, as per se, what ended up going on here was the fact that people ended up using the notes that this Scottish banker was printing and had them backed up by the King's guards, by the force of power that the King had at his availability. All right, nobody was going to sit there and tell the King of England that his notes weren't any damn good. Because what was the King of England? Well, he was a government. And what power has any government ever had throughout the course of history? It has never had any power other than the force of arms to back up whatever it was saying or whatever it was trying to do. This is very, very key when you turn around and you look at the monetary systems that we have developed today, or what it is that came out of Jekyll Island in the form of the Federal Reserve. Now, of course, a lot of people won't look at it this way, but the fact of the matter is, that money that we use today is what's called legal tender. And this legal tender is backed up by laws. As a matter of fact, all of our uniform commercial code laws are written around legal tender. There are still common law, precedents that have been set, and a few other items that go by constitutional law in various states around here that will back up the purchase of anything used by gold. But the fact of the matter is here, with these notes that we are using nowadays, nothing ever really gets paid off. And this is very, very key to understanding. You may have gained possession of something through the use of these notes. People may have been able to gain your labor because you agreed to it, because you accepted those notes. But in the end, those notes, until you have spent those notes on something else, are nothing more than a note. is very, very key to understand here. Because the fact of the matter is, when you have a constantly growing money supply, and a money supply which is outgrowing the goods and services that are available in a society, you have what's called inflation. And that inflation is very, very hidden. Now, that inflation occurs because they are printing notes against debt. Now, I want you to stop and think about something here. Real, real simple to think about. Okay? You are the position of printing notes. All right? Put yourself in a position of the Federal Reserve. Now, one thing you got to understand about the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve does not distribute money through any other form other than loans. The federal government gets money from the Federal Reserve. It comes in the form of a loan. Any money that comes out of the Federal Reserve comes out in the form of a loan. Now, one thing that we all understand and all know out there, that loans have to be paid back. They have to be paid back with interest. Now, I want you to stop and think about something. If the only currency that you are using out there are these notes, all right, and you are printing these notes and you are lending them out, you are expecting to get these same notes back plus more notes that have to come in interest, all right, because you're charging whoever it is you're lending these notes interest on. Well, unless you have printed those notes, you're not getting them back, all right? So what we have developed here, okay, well, let's face it, you got to print these notes, and you're going to have to lend them to other people and hope that those people out there do business with each other and pay off the loans to the Federal Reserve plus interest. All right. Well, the fact of the matter is, in order for them to keep on collecting interest on the money, they have got to find ways to print more notes. Okay? Because if they only print but so many notes to cover the goods and services and they lend them all out, they will not get the interest back on top of it. All right? Lending money is not a zero-sum game for these people. All right? You've got to understand that it all comes back in interest. So what we're talking about here is a huge Ponzi scheme. Now, regardless of what it is they are using underneath of this, generally the Federal Reserve, and if you go over to Fed 101, which is a very good website that explains how the Federal Reserve works, the Federal Reserve generally sells securities. And they sell things like bonds, they sell T-bills, they sell a variety of instruments. It's U.S. savings bonds, 10-year bonds, 20-year bonds, 30-year bonds, what have you. And they use these notes as a reserve. Now, a reserve is something that a bank is required to keep, or at least it was required to keep up until the last, few years here. And a reserve was something that had to be there in case a depositor came in looking to cash out and get his money in cash. Now, for the longest time, they were required to keep at least 10% of their accounts in reserve, willing to lend out the rest of it. Now, I would definitely highly recommend, for if you want a little better understanding of how this works, to go over to Google Videos and Google up debt versus money, or money as debt. Very, very good video. Will explain how it all works. But the point that I'm trying to make here is this, folks. All right, that in order for the Federal Reserve to get back what it lends out plus interest, and this is key, it has to print the money to cover the interest. And it's got to lend it back. Yeah, yes, it's true. Most of the debt is not held by the Federal Reserve. The debt is created, however, by the Federal Reserve. Okay, and it then sells that debt to other individuals or corporations or what have you. It sells it to other persons, whether they be actual persons or artificial persons in the form of corporations, makes no difference. Now, what this does, though, when they have got the power by law to create money, it's what you have done here is you've opened up a huge field for abuse, a very huge field for abuse. Nepotism, cronyism, and whatnot comes into play. All right, if you have the power of yay or nay over who gets loans, all of a sudden you'll start finding that people getting loans that shouldn't get the loans. You start finding money in the hands of people that really probably would not have had that money. Back in the days when money was actually real, you had to perform a real service for people. You had to produce real goods for people in order to get it. Nowadays, what we've run into is we've got a socialized system. and a socialized system is done out there to cover what are called the banks. All right, and this is a very funny thing. Prior to the formation of the Federal Reserve Bank, if your bank went out of business, you went bust with your bank. You know, people understood back then that when you gave your money to the banker, it was basically his money. And you had to trust that that banker was going to be able to make money with it. That when that banker made loans to people, that the loans he made were going to be good loans that were going to be paid back with interest. You know, way back when, in the dawn of time there, even with the Scotch banker, people understood this. People understood that, hey, Mr. Scott's banker, you know, what is going on here? We see that you are using our money to lend out there, and, hey, you know, and you are making money on it. You know, and it seems to me that you got a whole lot more notes out there going on than what you got actual money here. You know, where is our money? Well, the banker would just open up his vaults and say, look, I still got all your money right here. And they'd say, well, yeah, you still got our money, but the fact of the matter is you're making money off of it. So you want to keep our money in here. You're going to let us in on the game, which is why bankers started to pay interest to depositors. It was a business. You put your money in a bank and you would earn a certain percentage on it. Because the banker was earning a certain percentage on it. But when it comes down to the point where you don't have to have anything of any real intrinsic value behind your money, and you can print it at will, all of a sudden now it starts growing up in hands all over the place. And this is where we get back to. Now, this is not a new situation here. A lot of people had, had seen this happen in the past. As a matter of fact, one in particular, a man named Thomas Jefferson, had got put a handle on this. We've had various presidents and a lot of people in the past would do this. Matter of fact, I will tell you there was one person who was always basically for the idea of paper money and whatnot. And that man's name was Ben Franklin. But Ben Franklin has always had back then had problems with a lot of people. And I'm digging real hard here that it was that he had written, which I do have, and it was Thomas Jefferson that warned us against this. As a matter of fact, I will find this quote here. It's basically what he had said was that if we ever allowed a central bank to issue our currency, and I think we can put it right up here. Let me put it to you this way, and this is right straight from Thomas Jefferson quotes. And Thomas Jefferson said, I am convinced, the modern theory of the perpetuation of debt has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulated. The system of banking that we have, both equally and ever reprobated, I contemplate it as a blot left in all our constitutions, which if not covered will end in their destruction. I sincerely believe with you that the principle of spending money to be paid by posterity under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale. Now, the reason that the banks have been able to get away with this for so long, or still I haven't found the right quote yet, but it's coming, is that you don't ever feel the effects of it right away. When they come up and they print a lot of money and they ship it into the economy in one function or another, it generally relieves a problem that, on an immediate basis. Take note back when we were having problems that, whether or not you believe these problems were created by the Federal Reserve or created by the people that wanted to bring the Federal Reserve about, really makes no difference, at this particular point in time. The problem that they solved did not come to head for a few years, okay? These problems generally don't come to head for a few years down the road, because all of a sudden, what they find themselves in a position of doing here is having to pay off the debts that they wrote, all right, the bonds that had to get paid. And, Jesus, my throat is getting ripped up here tonight. I'm sorry, folks. I'm having a rough time talking. The point that I'm trying to make here is that eventually all debts come due, but they come due so far down the road that the apparency of the problems they create is put off. And once these problems come to fruition, they generally find their way to get out of it using the same method they got into it: printing more money, selling more securities. selling more securities and printing more money against them. You know, they sell a bond, and the bond's got to come due in 30 years. Okay, you buy a bond from the Federal Reserve. You know, say you spend $10,000 on the bond, and you're expecting in 30 years that you're going to get $20,000 back, some rate of interest. All right, well, that's fine and dandy. As long as the Federal Reserve had taken that $10,000, loaned it to someone responsible, got interest back on that loan, and was able to pay you with the interest that they got. But now don't forget, there is no reality underneath of this money. There is no underlying value. There is no intrinsic value to the money. So the Federal Reserve doesn't really give a shit whether that happens or not. Okay? What the Federal Reserve worries about is just taking its cut for its people along the line here. Alright, because they know damn well that when that bond comes due, all they're going to have to do is print the money to cover it. Even if printing that money requires them to sell a bond to someone else. And what they end up doing here is when they sell bonds, they promise to the bondholders that they're going to be judicious with their money, that they're going to put it in the right places, that it will earn interest, and they will get it back, you know, and with interest, and it, it will cut the bondholder in on the interest that they earn on it. Well, fact of the matter is that, you know, what they really end up doing is developing a Ponzi scheme. Yes, definitely caused by government spending. There's no doubt about that. Government spending is a huge thing to do with it. You know, now once you've got this power here in order to take the bond or to create money, you know, as you see fit, and, you know, you have a government that is willing to spend it to give it back to you. Well, let me put it to you this way. Basically, what's happened here is this. Jesus, my throat is going right to pieces. I don't know how long I'm going to be able to last this show tonight. But the point is this. Federal Reserve lends money to our federal government. And it does it for one reason, because the federal government has the ability to tax us to pay the interest on it. And this is very, very key. Okay, the Federal Reserve would not ever have come into fruition had it not been for the passage of the 16th Amendment, which allowed the government to bring in or to collect income from collect taxes on incomes from any source, as the 16th Amendment states. And it's very, very key. As is, well, what's the difference between the two? Stop and think about this. All right, the Treasury. The Treasury is the one that pays the Federal Reserve the interest on the notes. And they have gotten themselves into such a bind with all this that it's basically the Federal Reserve is more than willing to lend the federal government any money it asks for at any time it asks for it. That's the guarantee of the Federal Reserve to the Treasury Department, to the federal government. They've always had that. Which is why we were able to do things like the TARP bill, which is why the bailouts that came out this year for the various big banking institutions on Wall Street were able to happen. Okay? They did not have this amount of money. They did not have $780 billion in the Treasury. What they did was they borrowed that money from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve was more than willing to lend that money to the Treasury to do this, because they know that the Treasury has the ability to collect taxes from the people at large. And they can do so under the force of law. It goes right back to the same thing that Scotch Banker had there. It was because of the king's army, the king's men. Okay, because they have men with guns that are able to go out there and collect that money at the point of a gun. Now, of course, you know, you can go back and look at all our tax laws and say, well, yeah, but it's all voluntary. You know, there's no real compulsion going on there. It's voluntary compliance. Well, you go see what happens if you don't pay your taxes. All right? You just watch what happens. And the funny part about it is the Federal Reserve is always willing to lend them money. If we don't collect enough money in taxes to pay the interest on the notes that we carry with the Federal Reserve, it doesn't matter. The Federal Reserve will just turn around and lend you that money to pay the bill to themselves. You know, if you're let me just put it to you this way. Suppose you're in debt with a bank. You have a revolving charge account with a bank. All right? And the bank, you know, bank tells you, look, you know, we have a principal here, but the principal isn't due for 30 years down the road, and don't worry about that 30 years down the road. If we get to that point and you haven't paid it off, well, we'll refinance it. You just make the interest payments. Say you borrow $1 million from the bank, and your payments on this come out to, well, you know, just a random figure. We'll say your payments come out to $10,000 a month on this $1 million that you've borrowed over 30 years. Well, all of a sudden, if you come up to a month where you only got $5,000, you know, and in any normal situation with the rest of us, the bank is going to turn around and say, hey, we want some real assets here. We've got to have something. So we're going to take something from you and sell it and get that money. Well, the Federal Reserve does not treat the federal government this way. All right, the Federal Reserve turns around and says, no, look, don't worry about it. It's no problem. If you don't have the $10,000, you only got five, we'll lend you that five. So now, instead of the $1 million that you owed the federal government, okay, what you owe them now is $1 million plus $5,000. Because the federal government just loaned you that money to do this. Now, if you come around next month and you say the same thing, I only got $5,000 again, even though the payment now is $11,000, well, don't sweat it. We're just going to take that $6,000 and chop it right back onto the loan here. Okay, so now instead of owing us $1 million plus $5,000, you now owe us $1 million plus $11,000. And, of course, your payment will have gone up a little bit. Next month, you don't make the payment again. It keeps on going. What you end up doing here is you end up compounding the principal on your debt. Run that into the situation that has been happening over the last year. June of last year, 2009. What we had was a situation where the input to the Federal Reserve, where the amount of money collected by the federal government was off 20% from the year before. Now, you always hear about Congress raising the debt ceiling, which means basically they figure that they can raise the debt ceiling because they are collecting enough money in taxes in order to finance more debt. This is exactly what happened throughout the George W. Bush administration. All right, George W. Bush cut taxes and spurned the economy, and as such, raised the amount of money that we were collecting in taxes. There is no doubt about this. The tax revenues in this country went way up because of those cuts that were put forth by the George W. Bush administration. The problem was that the George W. Bush administration did not use that extra money that was coming in to pay down the principal. They looked at it as being able to raise the debt ceiling. They figure, hey, we only owe $10,000 a month to the Fed. Now, just figures that I'm using here. We're taking in $20,000. Okay, we owe them $10,000 on the million that we owe them. We owe them $10,000 a month. Well, hell, now we're taking in $20,000 a month. So instead of starting to pay that million down with $10,000 a month, they just turn around and say, oh, to hell with that. Let's go borrow another $10 million because now we're making enough money. And this is what happens. Every time those tax revenues go up, Congress finds another way to spend it. And what happens is they get themselves into a situation that when the economy turns around and tanks and the tax money isn't coming in, now they're stuck. You know, and what they're stuck with, they don't worry about because all that happens is that the Fed Reserve just keeps on pounding, keeps on multiplying the debt. They keep throwing whatever it is that you have not paid right onto the principal of the debt, which actually raises your payment each month. But if you're not making that payment, the amount of money that you're not making that payment with, they're just going to turn around and tell you, give me all that you have. Okay, which is exactly all that all of your tax dollars go to at this point in time. All right, we have reached a point in time now where every nickel that you spend in taxes goes directly to pay the interest on the debt to the Federal Reserve. Okay, the money that is taken from your check each week for Social Security to pay the interest on the debt to the Federal Reserve. Now, when the federal government decides to cut a check out for someone in benefits on Social Security, that check comes out in the form of a loan from the Federal Reserve, and interest is paid on that loan. And of course, if there isn't enough money to pay the interest, what you get at this point in time now is an accumulation of debt. Google up the words debt clock and take a look at what we actually got out there. It's unbelievable. You will see that debt clock spinning down in the $1 million range. And it's because of the activities of our federal government, the Federal Reserve, and what they have gotten into by the use of this monetary system. This is a bad idea. What we have ended up doing in order to try to keep this beast fed is, you know, over the years we raised taxes. Well, we all know that raising taxes has its own problems. It takes your good, honest businesses out there and it drives them overseas. Okay? But the worst part about it, and I'm here to tell you this for every single one of you liberals out there that's listening tonight, okay, who will all sit there and tell me that, businesses go overseas for labor costs, they don't go for taxes. Well, yes, indeed, in fact, I'm here to agree with you and tell you that they do go overseas because of labor costs. But do you know why those labor costs go up? It is because of the hidden tax of inflation. Right, because labor costs here are so much higher. And here's the real kick in the ass for the American economy. What has happened? I want everybody to stop and think about everything over the years here, especially the older folks out there like myself. You know, those of us that were born in the 40s and the 50s. You know, we all grew up with one parent staying at home, generally our mother, while our father went out and worked a job that managed to cover everything. Sometimes your dad worked two jobs. You know, my father worked part-time 3-4 nights a week to help make ends meet. But mom never had to work, all right? He had a mortgage back then of $50 a month. That was it on a $9,000 home. The result of what has this Federal Reserve has been putting up with here has caused cheap money to enter the system. When cheap money enters into your system, into your economic system, and it's unchecked by any natural law, what happens is inflation. And inflation is the worst kind of a hidden tax. I take a look at my parents' house and the house that they bought for $9,000 back in the 50s. That house today, last time I looked, $270,000 it was worth. Now, I will grant you, my parents have put a couple roofs on that house in the time they've had it. They finished it off. They did a nice job, put aluminum siding on it, did a lot of good improvements to that home to keep it up, to keep it a fairly modern home. But let me tell you something, folks. Its value is still the same. Its value is still a place that keeps you warm. Okay, its value is still a place where you can lock up your goods. It's a place where you can lock up your toys. It's still a place to keep you warm in the winter, cool in the summer, a place for you to go and relax. It is your climate control system. That is what its actual value is. The value of the house didn't go from $9,000 to $270,000. Okay, it's not worth what a home that would have went for $270,000 was back when that house was only worth $9,000. Because the house that was $270,000 back when that house was worth $9,000 is worth millions today. But the fact of the matter is here, the point that I'm trying to make is that it's not the value of the house that went up. It's the value of the money that went down. Okay? And that is the point. All right, now, Pox, you're sitting here trying to tell me that I'm wrong, that most of the debt is not held by the Fed, okay? Look, the most of the debt that is held by the Fed is the debt of the federal government, okay? The federal government owes all of its debt, okay, to the Federal Reserve, all right, through one institution or another. But in the end, it's the Federal Reserve that writes all of it. And we're actually all in that exact same boat. Right? Every single bank in this country is a subsidiary of the Federal Reserve. Now, the Fed will sit down and tell you that the Federal Reserve is a lot to the public, yes, and a lot to foreigners, okay? But it doesn't worry about what it owes to the public and the foreigners, because in order to pay the public and the foreigners, it can always print the money that it has to use to pay them off. What it does here, okay? And that's the big point that I'm trying to make here. It can always do that. Now, what happens along with all this, and Pox, you know you're going to agree with me, is that it's inflation. Now, inflation just keeps on going up. And I want you to stop and think again here, okay? Go back to the 50s. Go back to the 60s, okay, when we all grew up as kids. You know, we didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have a lot of things, you know. You know, you got hand-me-down clothes, you know. But fact of the matter is, you know, like I was trying to say there before, with just my father working at his job, we always had food on the table. You know, we always had the clothing we needed. We always made it to school on time. We were able to take vacations every year. Nowadays, you can't do that. All right? Nowadays, a household doesn't work, okay, unless you've got two parents working in it, okay? One of the big things, and it's because of that hidden tax of inflation. If you turn around and you look at things, okay, it's never caught up with the prices of goods and services in the marketplace is wages. Wages have never caught up with it. All right, and as a result, what it has done is forced more and more families out of the door and into the workplace in order to cover the prices of things. And what I'm trying to make, the point that I'm trying to make here to you is that inflation itself is a hidden tax. All right, and because of the spending, and don't forget, the spending goes on all over the place. All right, what you end up with is what Thomas Jefferson was worried about. All right, where large corporations being formed all over the place. Some of the most evil things in the world. All right, that some people are out there talking about. Now, I'm not sitting here trying to tell you, or any other conservative that's sitting in the room here, that that all large corporations are bad. You know, I'm not that stupid. I would never say something like that. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that the bad corporations that do rise up out there are out there because there is a source of cheap money. All right? And they're out there because of the lending system that we have in this country and because of who it is that ends up with this money and who it is that ends up with all this paper. That's right. Mom and Pop can't make a jumbo jet. I'm not talking about jumbo jet makers. All right, but there are still many other large corporations out there, okay, some of the multinationals out there that the libs do get upset about, that they're absolutely right about. You know, Monsanto being one of them, which I got my real problems with Monsanto, despite, the, you know, some of the good that they have done. You know, the evil that's come along with them has not been a pretty thing. You know, some of the moves that they have made have not been pretty things. But the point that I'm trying to make is that now we are in a position where the federal government owns almost 70% of the mortgages in this country. By the time we get done and you look at the bottom of the barrel and you look all the way to the depth of paperwork and everything else that goes on out there, Thomas Jefferson's worst fears have come true. Damn if I could find this quote. I had it put up here earlier on, but it just got away from. But he basically stated way back when that if we ever allowed a central bank to take over control of the issuing of currency and to control our economy by inflation and deflation or by the contraction or expansion of credit, that one day we would wake up homeless on the ground that our forefathers shed their blood for. And we're damn near there. We have almost got to do that, okay? Yes, Pox, listen, I'm not here to argue with you over any of the good things that come about, all right? But you will also take note that these good things that come about take more and more money all the time. Look at health care, all right? Everybody out there is going to sit down and tell you, look at how fast all the health care costs are going up. And I'm here to tell you that health care costs go up for many reasons, but the biggest reason being because of the devaluation of the currency that drives them up. And what are the evils that come in behind this? Well, you got half the country out there yelling for the government to form a healthcare system. Right, well, the good old days, you did die. You know what I mean? But healthcare is coming along where it is. But the reason that healthcare costs keep climbing the way they do is because of inflation. You know, and that's the point that I'm trying to make, all right? And that inflation is caused by an ever and ever expanding monetary supply, where the money that you are making is being robbed of its value on a daily basis. I want you to stop and think about something here, all right? Stop and think about this for a minute. You go out there and you borrow, You got your eye on a car. All right, it's a car that you wanted all your life, or any object, whatever the hell it is. All right, but it's not an object that you're going to be able to take and dig into your pocket and buy. Okay, it's not an object that you're going to be able to cover with 1 week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks pay in order to buy it, whatever it is. It's an object that you're going to end up having to save for a few years. 40, 50, 60 years ago, you could have saved for that object, and people did. Okay, people saved for cars. People saved to have a huge chunk to put down on their homes. People saved money for a big reason. Nowadays, you can't do that. And it's not even worth your while to do that. All right. Nowadays, if you want that car, or you want that motorcycle, or you want that object that's going to cost you many, many, many weeks of saving, you realize damn full well that if you try to put your money away to save for it, you'll never be able to catch up. Because as you, you know, when you start out looking at it, that object that costs $10,000 or $20,000, you know, and you set a goal, say, well, I'm making, you know, $200 a week, and if I save $20 a week, after this many weeks, I'll be able to buy that object. You know, the problem is that after this many weeks, okay, when you have saved enough money to pay for that object, you know, after your 3 or 4 years of saving, its price has climbed beyond the amount of money that you could have possibly saved for it. And you put yourself into a spin where you will never be able to save for it. So what is it that you end up doing instead? You go and you borrow the money. You know, and that's the big key here. Now the bankers got you right where they want you. You borrowed that money. They got you in debt. Okay? And it's obviously, it's advantageous because of the monetary system they set up for you, okay? They have made it much easier for you, all right, to go purchase that object right away. Because now you're in a different situation. Now you have actually locked the payments in. Those payments are going to be a set price over the next 4, 5, 6 years, whatever it is. Okay, and hopefully, if everything goes along according to plan, you know, your pay will go up and you'll actually be paying back for that item with cheaper dollars. I mean, it was 20 years ago, you'd hear economists out there telling you, smartest move you could make is if you're gonna buy something, to stretch the payments out for as long as you possibly could. So that by the time rolled around that you were actually paying it off, you were paying it off with money that took you next to nothing to obtain. Alright, what happens here is that you have inserted a banking community into the transactions of every single American out there. There's no transactions that banks do not get themselves involved in. And this, my friend, is basically the way I look at it, this is slavery. Alright, these people have got us by the short and curlies. There's no doubt about it, because you cannot go out there and save for anything. Alright, you can't. I mean, it's just the way it is. What they have also done is torn the American family apart. The mother that used to raise her kids is now having her kids raised by a daycare center. Okay, she is not raising her kids, okay? You know, the mother for her kids is no longer the woman that you married, all right? Who is it instead? It's whoever the hell the two people are on the TV that they're watching, going through whatever. Yeah, well, you know, look, I'm not going to say that there aren't people out there that won't do this. I've sold cars for cash. I've sold cars for 10 years, you know, and I'll tell you what. No doubt about the fact that older people would come in every now and then and write a check for it. Okay? But would you like to have a nice Porsche? Are you in a position of being able to go and purchase a Porsche? You know, have you got $190,000 to go out and buy that nice Targa? No. You know, maybe you do. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. Okay, the point that I'm trying to make for the majority of people out there, for the common people that were able to do this, okay, 30, 40, 50 years ago, are not able to do it anymore, you know, and that's the biggest problem that you're running into, all right, that's the point that I'm trying to make. Yeah, some of us make it. Okay, but the fact of the matter is, more and more people end up falling through the cracks. More and more people turn around and instead of questioning the money supply and how the money is managed out there, what do they end up doing? They go to cry to the government for relief. All right, so now you're in a bigger catch-22 situation. You know, the point that I'm trying to make here is a very insidious thing. What happens is when these banks got themselves into the government. All right, because what have the banks done along with this, okay? You know, like I had stated earlier on in the show here, you put your money into a bank, you are going into a partnership with the owners of that bank, with the board of directors, the owner himself, whether it was a co-op, what have you. But if that bank lost money, all right, what happened? Okay, the bank went down the tubes. You all lost money with the bank. All of the depositors lost as well as the banker. All right, nowadays that doesn't happen. Why is that? Because we have socialized the risk with taxes. Okay, now if your banker loses money, well, your funds are insured. Your funds are insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So you have nothing to worry about. And everybody acts as if, well, it's no big deal, you know. Hell, they pay insurance premiums into this. Yeah, well, the fact of the matter is, what have they been having to do over the last, last 3-4 years here? You know, they raised the amount of money that was insured and conversely raised the premiums to the banks. Now, when they did this, what did that take the bank savings rates or interest paid on savings down to? All-time lows. What are you getting, 0.25% or 1% now? You know, when I was a kid and you put money into the bank, you'd get 4 to 5% interest out of a bank. You can't even get 1% interest out of a bank now. It doesn't work that way. Bank would rather lend you money than it would be to hold on to your money and try to pay you interest on it. All right. Fact that I'm trying to say here is that inflation. Inflation has been the big hidden tax behind all of this. And the monetary supply and where the money is going and where the paper ends up going is in all the wrong places. You know? And it's been taken out of the hands of the people themselves. You know, which is exactly what Thomas Jefferson was worried about. Way back when. You know, he told us back then. Let me see here. To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power, no longer susceptible of any definition. The incorporation of a bank and the powers assumed by this bill, which was what he was talking about, was chartering the First Bank of the United States, have not, in my opinion, been delegated by the United States Constitution. They are not among the powers specially enumerated. And he said, I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to the Constitution, taking from the federal government their power of borrowing from privately owned banks. And he also said, we are undone, my dear sir, if legislation is still permitted, which makes our money, much or little, real or imaginary, as the moneyed interests shall choose to make it. I think he was absolutely right with everything that he said back then. You know, Thomas Jefferson really hit the nail on the head here. He took that power of coinage away from the people here. Your coins are basically worth shit nowadays. You know, you got to stop and think about something. Stop and think about the little things in life, you know. That's why I said before, look, my father used to only bring home 55, 60 bucks a week. But he was able to afford to own his own home. He was able to afford to feed and clothe 6 kids. Okay? Able to give us all new bicycles for Christmas. He was able to do way more back then with that $50 a week. Okay? Then my 25-year-old son is able to do now with $400 a week. Alright? That's the point that I'm trying to make here. Okay? My kid, making the money that he's making, could not afford to go out there and buy a house right now. There's just no way in hell he'd be able to do it. Still living here at home. Alright? You know? And it's not like he's, you know, he's behind the times. It's not like he's stupid. It's not like he's lazy. He works his ass off. You know? I had my oldest daughter. Got a degree, making 6 figures. All right, her and her husband, who I think is bordering on working, making 6 figures. Finally looking at buying a home and worried shitless about whether or not the economy is going to be around to be able to do it. But still, even with the amount of money they are making, okay, they're only going to be able to afford a very modest home. You know, and probably my daughter will end up having to go back to work as soon as her child is old enough to go to school. You know, this is wrong. That's the point that I'm trying to make. Our society is becoming torn apart by this. And that, my friends, is what is wrong about all of it. All right, at any rate, I hope I got some explanation of what I'm talking about here. You know, when you have taken money, just to try to sum it all up here before I close the show up for tonight, when you have taken money away from having any intrinsic value, natural market forces do not cover its quantity and its value in the marketplace. You have subverted natural forces. You have put into place artificial forces. You have put into place what is called fiat, all right, which is means by proclamation or by edict. Okay, the money that you have out there in the federal government that makes no bones about calling it fiat money, which is what it is money by nothing more than their proclamation. It has no intrinsic value to it whatsoever. So natural market forces are no longer in command. And what you end up with now, okay, is you do not have free markets. You do not have free enterprise. You have got an enterprise and you have markets that are strictly controlled by the banking industry. and by the vultures that run at the very, very top at the banking industry. And that's the point that I'm trying to make. All right? And that's, you know, I mean, most of the social ills that you can see out there, you know, a long time ago, you know, Jesus Christ, you know, made the statement that money is the root of all evil. And, you know, in a way, he was right. But what he was talking about way back then was the actual money that was being scripted and used by the Pharisees in the temple. Also, you might happen to, you know, if you know your history and you know your Bible, you'll understand when Christ made that statement, it was right after throwing the money changers out of the temple. You know the words that I'm talking about, money changers. All right, these are people who are changing money. Money is what money is. All right, there's no getting around what actual money is. And I've never had a problem with actual money. You know, because money does, and money is a good thing. You know what I mean? I mean, let me put it to you this way. Just a few quotes from Ayn Rand way back when. You know, have you ever asked what is the root of money? You know, money is a tool of exchange which can't exist unless there are goods produced and men able to produce them. Money is the material shape of the principle that men who wish to deal with one another must deal by trade and give value for value. Money is not the tool of the moochers who claim your product by tears, or of the looters who take it from you by force. Money is made possible only by the men who produce. When you accept money in payment for your effort, you do so only on the conviction that you will exchange it for the product of the efforts of others. It is not the moochers or the looters who give value to money. Not an ocean of tears nor all the guns in the world can transform those pieces of paper into your wallet. I'm sorry, we'll transform those pieces of paper in your wallet into the bread you will need to survive tomorrow. Those pieces of paper, which should have been gold, are a token of honor, your claim upon the energy of the men who produce. Your wallet is your statement of hope that somewhere in the world around you there are men who will not default on that moral principle, which is the root of money. Have you ever looked at the root of production? Take a look at an electric generator and dare tell yourself that it was created by the muscular effort of unthinking brutes. Try to grow a seed of wheat without the knowledge left to you by the men who had to discover it for the first time. Try to obtain your food by means of nothing but physical motions, and you'll learn that man's mind is the root of all the goods produced and of all the wealth that ever existed on earth. You know, some say that money is made by the strong at the expense of the weak. Now, what strength do you mean? It's not the strength of guns and muscles. Wealth is the product of man's capacity to think. This is very important. But the fact of the matter is, to trade by means of money is the code of men of goodwill. Money rests on the axiom that every man is the owner of his mind and his effort. Money allows no power to prescribe the value of your effort except by the voluntary choice of the man who is willing to trade you his efforts in return. Money permits you to obtain for your goods and your labor that which they are worth to the men who buy them, but no more. Money permits no deals except those to mutual benefit by the unforced judgment of the traders. Money demands of you the recognition that men must work for their own benefit, not for their own injury, for their gain, not their loss. The recognition that they are not beasts of burden born to carry the weight of your misery. That you must offer them values, not wounds. That the common bond among men is not the exchange of suffering, but the exchange of goods. Money demands that you sell not your weakness to men's stupidity, but your talent to their reason. It demands that you buy not the shoddiest they offer, but the best your money can find. And when men live by trade, with reason, not force as their final arbiter, it is the best product that wins, the best performance, the man of best judgment and highest ability. And the degree of a man's productiveness is the degree of his own reward. And the big point that I'm trying to make about all this, now this is not a stretch there, Pox. All right, the point that I'm trying to make here is that when you have an honest monetary system, these are the kinds of things that come true. All right, because men live by trade. And what their arbiter of trade is reason, not force. Okay, when the arbiter of trade is force, when the arbiter of trade is a federal government that is using its guns to back up its power to tax you, when it's using guns to enforce its legal currency laws or its legal tender laws, okay, when it uses guns to back up all the uniform intricacies of the income tax code and of the uniform commercial code and the legal tender laws and all the rest of it, you have thrown reason out the window. You've thrown sanity out the window, and what you've thrown out the window with it is honesty and freedom. You have thrown your liberty out the window with it. And as such, I'm here to tell you something, my friend, that there are no free markets anymore. Because you do not have money that is issued by a free people, because you have money that is no longer have any intrinsic value to it whatsoever, okay, money that is backed up by nothing more than the good faith and credit of the United States of America, by a bunch of thugs and thieves that sit in Washington, D.C., okay, that money has lost its value, okay? You can no longer go out and deal in the marketplace using reason, okay? You get too much fraud in the marketplace. You get those who are allowed into the marketplace by fraud, you know, due to those who control and issue the money. I'm here to tell you something, my friend, and until we get back to that, we are headed down a damn slippery slope. Because what will end up happening here is this debt that we are accumulating is going to keep on growing beyond control. We are getting to a point now where it is almost beyond control. The Chinese, which are very, very unwilling at this point in time to buy any of our bonds, this bond auction that will go off the end of this week is going to tell you a lot about what's going on out there. But people are starting to realize, all right, that the amount of interest that we owe on all of the bonds that we have sold out there is getting beyond the ability of the population of the United States of America to pay off. All right? And once people start waking up to that fact, let me tell you something. You remember a long time ago, okay? You know, you used to have to, you were your third, fourth, fifth grade, your teacher would hand you a problem. You know, if four men can build a house in 10 days, how many days will it take seven men to build the house? And you had to do an equation like that. Well, let me tell you something. You know, if 300 million people working, okay, can pay X amount of dollars in interest, okay, well, then how much debt can they carry? You better stop and think about that, because the amount of debt that we're carrying out there can't be paid by every single person in this country working 40 hours a week. Can't be done. And we have reached that. Let me tell you something. The Chinese have done the math here. They understand this. Other people around the world that were buying our bonds understand this. Okay? Yeah, inflation destroys debt. You know, deflation. Well, yeah, sure, it destroys debt. Sure it does. Takes and kills it, you know, which is what's going on right now. They're trying to inflate their way out of this debt. But the fact of the matter is, you know, the people who are going to end up getting paid off with all of this inflated dollars are going to find that those dollars ain't worth shit by the time they get them in their hands and they want to go buy something with it. All right? Weimar Republic, bring anything to mind here with you? Taking wheelbarrows of money to go and buy a loaf of bread? I'm not saying we've hit that point yet. You know, I'm hoping that we never hit that point. But if we don't bring some sanity back in, if we don't cut this government spending, and if we don't get down to a point where we have something intrinsic behind our dollars, okay, we are sunk. That's all there is to it. All right, folks, with that, we've hit the top of the hour here, the top of the show. I want to thank everybody for coming in tonight. I hope my explanation was good. If there are questions or anything or any comments that you folks would like to make, feel free to email me. It's thepoliticscafe@gmail.com. Be glad to take a look at any of them, answer any that I can. And I want to tell you all good night. Once again, the Mater D has got everything all cleaned up. This guy I hired last year, he's just been the best maid. I might have to open up another restaurant and put him in charge of it. Well, once again, the tables are all piled high with the chairs. The lights are dim. Cafe and the kitchen are all shut down, but as always, the bar will be open. Politics Lobby 4 is going to be open for a while here, and the first round of drinks is always on me. So, folks, once again, from the Politics Cafe at www.hernco.com, Hi, I'm your host, Mark Belcher. We're going to sign it off for tonight. Thank you all for coming. Should be another show next week and maybe the week after that on Monday night, but come February, we will be moving the show to Saturday. During the day, we're going to open up over there. Taking Back America with Zan O'Neill is going to be on there along with me on Saturday morning, along with all the other really good shows at Hernco.com, the Golf Club Show, tons of stuff. The Hawaiian Automotive Show, which is really good. And all the good things that you will find at Hernco.com will be there. All right, folks, good night from the Politics Cafe. Thanks for coming.